The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, bonjour, hi Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Tuesday, June 23rd in the year of the plague, 2020. A lot to do today. Secretary Pompeo, Senator Cotton, the Heritage Hour, HughForHeritage.com, and a very long interview with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, which I will begin in just a moment. Let me, however, begin with the business story of the day brought to you by Birch Gold, because it's a big story. Birch Gold, by the way, can be reached by texting my name Hugh to 474747, or simply going to HughGold.com. That's HughGold.com. I told you months ago to get into gold, and gold this morning is up to $1,771 an ounce. I originally told you to diversify when it was at $1,400. I still believe you need to take 10 to 20% of your retirement and allow the people at Birch Gold to help you put that into a secure precious metals-backed IRA. And you do that by going to HughGold.com or texting my name, Hugh, to 474747. From the Financial Times this morning, European stocks lifted by signs of fledging economic recovery. European stocks rose on Tuesday after a key survey pointed to early signs that a recovery was taking hold in the region's crisis-hit economy. That is great news. Now, yesterday in America, the Dow was up 153 points, the NASDAQ was up 110, and the S&P was up 20. Amazon went up 1.5%, $38. I think it's marching to 4,000, but I own Amazon, so that might be the wish coming forth as a statement. But it's the only stock I own, I always tell you that. But popping 1.5% yesterday, I just think is amazing. So the big story of the day, I think, is economic recovery across the globe, but especially here in America. Remember, HughGold.com. I sat down with Secretary Robert Gates, who served as SecDef under both Presidents Obama and George W. Bush, yesterday to discuss his new book, Exercise of Power. Here is part one. Pleased to welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show now Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who served in that job under President George W. Bush and under President Obama, and a lifetime of service, including as National Security Advisor and at the CIA. He has got a brand new book out, Exercise of Power, which I'm holding up in my hand, which absorbed my Father's Day weekend. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Great to have you on.
Thanks, Hugh. Really a pleasure to be back.
Now, you began your career out of William & Mary at the Central Intelligence Agency. I began my career a decade later with Richard Nixon in his exile in San Clemente as a ghostwriter. We were both working on China. The end of this book, Exercise of Power, is all about China. It hasn't turned out how any of us expected, has it, Mr. Secretary?
Well, you know, Hugh, I make the point in the book, in the China chapter, that the first 20 years of the relationship really was quite geostrategic. There really wasn't a significant economic component to it. For Nixon and Kissinger, it was all about the relationship with Russia and how do you use China against Russia, and better to have a warm relationship with China to be able to exploit. And then the same was true with even Carter. And I was involved at the end of the Carter administration in implementing the deal between President Carter and Deng Xiaoping to build American intelligence radars in Western China to spy on Soviet missile tests. So through about 1980 or so, it really was a geostrategic relationship where each saw it in its mutual advantage. Then with the advent of Deng Xiaoping's reforms and China's slow but accelerating growth, The economic component of the relationship really began to get underway in the 1980s and culminated early in the Clinton administration when we helped China get into the World Trade Organization. And then the economic relationship and China's economy both just exploded. So it really, the last half of the 40 years or so of the relationship have been when it's been dominated by the economy. And I would just make two additional points. I think particularly during the economic growth phase of this, from, let's say, in the 80s until until the current time, the belief has been that a richer China would be a freer China. That was a mistaken assumption. And then the second thing that we didn't anticipate was that a richer China would become a more assertive China. So that's kind of, I think, how the relationship evolved. And it's only been in the last 3 or 4 years that the U.S. has begun to challenge those assumptions that proved wrong.
Now, Mr. Secretary, for people who they can see how heavily annotated the book is, and one line is underscored, such high hopes. This was a bipartisan decision to buy into the China idea. Have both parties come to the recognition, in your view, and you are respected on both sides, I think you're the last man in America who actually has the respect of both party elites. Do both parties understand, in your view, now that the CCP is not our friend and they're not going to be our friend for a very long time?
I think so, Hugh. I think it's probably about the only thing you can point to these days where there's any kind of bipartisan agreement. And they're going to kind of have, I think that the two presidential candidates are going to have kind of dueling campaigns this fall about who's tougher on China. And so, yeah, it's one of the few areas of bipartisanship. And you can see it in the fact that there's like 200 different pieces of legislation punishing China in one form or another up on the Hill in both the House and the Senate.
Mr. Secretary, in exercise of power, you don't use the term Cold War 2.0. Is it appropriate to say we are in Cold War 2.0?
I think so. You know, we can dance around it and pretend that it's not going to be the same. I think actually in some ways it is potentially a little riskier in the sense that over time we negotiated a number of arms control agreements and other kinds of assurances with the Soviets to make sure we avoided a military conflict. First, the arms control agreements that limited the number of nuclear weapons that we had. It basically codified what both sides wanted to do, but it provided predictability in the arms race. You know, you knew the other guy couldn't build more than X missiles or Y nuclear weapons. And we negotiated a lot of agreements to avoid incidents blowing up into major confrontations. So we negotiated the incidents at sea agreement with the Soviets. We negotiated how we would observe each other's military exercises and so on. We really don't have any of those agreements with China at all. So at this point, the relationship and the confrontations, particularly in the South China Sea, are kind of ungoverned space. And one of my minor achievements when I was secretary was getting a direct phone line put in between the Secretary of Defense and the Minister of Defense in China. And all I can say is that I think that if I were to ever use that line, there probably wouldn't be anybody at the other end of the phone, because the Minister of Defense has relatively no power in China.
Mr. Secretary, when we talk about China today, you are very clear. The transition from Deng Xiaoping to General Secretary Xi has been one of an accumulation of power in the position of the General Secretary. Did you expect that when you were young in your career? Did you expect that when you were SecDef under either President Bush or President Obama, that the General Secretary would become basically president for life in China?
Well, you know, the collective leadership principle generally prevailed through Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. They maintained the collective leadership. They observed the term limits. They left after their 2 5-year terms. I think that the real sea change toward one-man rule really has just begun with Xi Jinping. And the problem with one-man rule is that when you're responsible for everything, you're responsible for everything. And anything goes wrong, there's only one address. And that's one of the risks he's undertaking. When you have a collective leadership, you can sort of spread the blame around if something goes wrong. But now it's all him.
We'll be back with more Secretary Gates after the break, America. I can't stress for you enough what he just said, that we are in Cold War II. I'm going to talk with Secretary Pompeo about that in second hour today, Tom Cotton as well. Secretary Gates may be the most respected man in both sides of the aisle, and he's blunt, to the point. I may bring it up with my guest from the Heritage Foundation, viewforheritage.com, as well in hour number three. That's a big deal for Bob Gates to say Cold War 2.0. Stick around. I'll be right back. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Here's part two of my interview with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. Do you think he may face a Khrushchev moment, by which I mean that moment at which the Politburo of the Soviet Union came to Nikita Khrushchev and said, "We are unhappy with the way you are doing things. You're out." Does the General Secretary face any kind of risk like that?
I think when you have this kind of a authoritarian regime, the leader always faces that kind of a risk. Now, he's taken, like most authoritarians, he's taken significant steps to make sure he controls the army, to make sure he controls the security services, and to plant his people so that he will get advance word. I remember I joined CIA just a couple of years after Khrushchev was ousted, and we took a lot of heat for not predicting that. And my response was, well, Khrushchev had all the intelligence resources there were in the Soviet Union, and he didn't see it coming, so how can you expect us to have gotten it? So, you know, in one of these regimes, you just don't know.
So, Mr. Secretary, going back to your legendary budget battles within the Obama administration, they're the stuff of Beltway lore. I want to look ahead, and I really don't want to get you involved in a partisan fight. I want to draw on your expertise. Are we spending enough in the right places to equip ourselves for a Cold War 2.0?
I think we are. I think in the military sense, Hugh, we are. I have a feeling we probably could spend it better and more wisely. I felt that way the whole time I was in office and tried to do some things about that in terms of shifting money around and so on. The problem with the military budget is that I like to describe it, if you were to graph the military budget over a period of years, it would look like the EKG of a fibrillating heart. The problem is the lack of sustainability. They'll have a couple of fat years and then a couple of lean years. And if they could just count on getting, say, 4% or even 3% real growth over inflation, but over a sustained period of time, 10 years or something like that, you could really make a lot of efficiencies in the department and save a lot of money. Because when you get a lot of money, if you know the next year is going to be lean, then you spend it as fast as you can. And that's just flat not efficient. And you could stretch out production schedules and so on. But the other part of this competition with China that we're going to have for as long into the future as we can see, where we are drastically underfunded, is in the non-military instruments of power. It's in our diplomacy, it's in our strategic communications, it's in our development assistance, it's in the way we use cyber politically and a variety of our economic tools. We are deeply underfunded, we lack any kind of coordination, and it's kind of open field running. And I would say one of the issues that I have with the president and the administration is they also don't seem to understand the that it's not a great idea to antagonize everybody in the world at the same time. One of our unique assets in the United States is our allies and friends. Nobody's pushed the Chinese, or nobody's pushed our allies harder than I did to spend more on defense. But at the end of the day, it's like Churchill said, the only thing worse than not having it, not only thing worse than having allies is not having allies.
And none of our allies are remotely as much a pain in the neck as Charles de Gaulle was to Winston Churchill. I mean,
that's for sure. It's not even close. It's in this non-military arena where, frankly, we, since the end of the Cold War, have unilaterally disarmed, that the Chinese have invested huge sums of money. Hu Jintao, a few years ago, invested $7 billion to improve their strategic communications. And we don't have anything like that. And what we do have is disaggregated, and there's no strategy for it. So I would say on the military side, we're probably in pretty good shape if the current level of spending or rate of growth in spending can be sustained. On the non-military side, the Chinese are beating the pants off of us.
Wow. I'll be right back with more Secretary Gates after the break. It is Tuesday, June the 23rd. Don't forget as well, flattenthefear.com, a project of the Job Creators Network. Flattenthefear.com makes it possible for you to understand when your business can reopen, when it ought to reopen. Head over to flattenthefear.com and come back for more of Secretary Gates here on the UUH Show. Welcome back, America. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has a new book out, Exercise of Power. Here's my conversation with him. I want to go to page 65 to my favorite line in the book, Mr. Secretary. Outside of the White House, to the outsider, this all sounds like a bunch of bureaucratic mumbo jumbo. You are referring to the interagency process there, the process by which policy is made. And it does sound like bureaucratic mumbo jumbo. It has not been coherent, in my view, since Dr. Rice was running the NSA. Stephen Hadley was pretty coherent. It just has not been coherent. O'Brien is a friend of mine, a very dear friend. I think it's beginning to be coherent again. Do you think we can recapture strategic coherence in the policy coordination between the White House, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense, and to the extent that the Department of Justice is involved in counterintelligence, DOJ? Is that possible to get back?
Hugh, I think only if the president embraces it. The only way the system works is if people know that if people in the different agencies, even at the cabinet level, know that that's what the president, that's the kind of process that the president wants. I would say even Condi Rice and Steve Condi Rice had a problem because of the rivalry, if you will, between Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld, and between Colin and the White House, and so on. And, to tell you the truth, I think the model for when it ran the best was under Bush 41, because he had an extraordinary process, and he had a team like Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft and Dick Cheney over at State, and there was a real cohesive spirit of teamwork there. I think that worked pretty well in the last years of the Bush administration when I was there, because Condi and I had been friends, and Hadley and I had been friends for many, many years, so we worked together pretty seamlessly. And the same thing, really, in some ways, for the first couple of years of the Obama administration. But if you have as I say in the book, for most of my career, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense weren't even on speaking terms. And that makes it pretty tough for the interagency process to work.
I recently wrote for the Post that back in the days when I was a young staffer in the White House, Secretary, then Chief of Staff James Baker, National Security Advisor Clark, and Secretary of Defense Weinberger had the relationship that Gates and Condi and Hadley had. What is it that is so hard to get about that mix? Because that's actually the secret sauce. If you can get those three people the chief of staff, the national security advisor, the secretary of state, excuse me, the secretary of defense going with the secretary of state involved. You've got actually the team in place. Why is that so hard to do?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, in all of those cases, those people had all known each other and worked together for a number of years in earlier administrations. I mean, I first met Brent Scowcroft in the Ford administration, actually in the last days of the Nixon administration when I was on the NSC. So we had known each other for ages. The second was that these people were all experienced. They had considerable experience in government. And in each case, you had a president who was willing and insisted on having a coherent decision-making process. I remember one of my favorite anecdotes when I was chairing the deputies committee, which kind of ran the interagency process under President Bush, first President Bush. There was a big debate in the Situation Room about what the president wanted. And I just kind of pushed my chair back and I said, well, I'll just go ask him. And so I walked up to the Oval Office, went in, said, here's the problem. He said what he wanted. I went back down. I said, here's what the president wants. And everybody, I mean, there's no rejoinder to that. The meeting was able to move on from that moment. But that's the kind of engagement on the part of the president that's needed. And now, and I guess a final thought I'd say is in government, as well as kind of anything, in my view, consensus is the enemy. And one of the things that the presidents that I worked for tried to avoid, actually, was consensus. They wanted disparate points of view because they wanted to be making the decisions. They didn't want solutions coming to them fully baked by the bureaucracy so that they didn't have any choices about what to do.
Mr. Secretary, I'm kind of a connoisseur of memoirs. I may be the only one who read, and I joked with Secretary Kerry, the only one that read every page of Secretary Kerry's memoir. And we had a great conversation about it. But I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat. I read them because that's how you figure out what happened. What you have said that from your memoir that was the most controversial thing is that Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, hadn't been right on any major foreign policy issue in 40 years. Do you worry about a Biden administration and that fundamental inability to grasp great power competition infecting that West Wing?
Yeah, I stand by that statement. I will say, Hugh, it related mainly to things that had happened in the Cold War. Biden voted against every single arms program, I think, that Ronald Reagan put up on the Hill. He voted for the Iraq War and so on. So I do have those policy differences with him. I will say in the Obama administration, we did have a very deep disagreement on Afghanistan, and that was a big deal. But on issues like intervening in Libya and dumping Mubarak in Egypt, he and I actually were on the same side on those issues. So and the other thing I write about in the book that hasn't gotten much attention is that I also think that the vice president had some issues with the military, and I wrote in Duty about how he would warn the president that he was being boxed in, that the military was trying to take away his options and so on. And he'd kind of rail at the generals and that bothered me some. So, there are puts and takes with, any presidential candidate. He brings a decency and an integrity and so on to the race. But I did have these issues with him.
Let me ask you about a far more deep question, Mr. Secretary, because it makes you look out 40 years, having spent 40 years doing this. I don't think the bench is very deep in either party. And I believe a lot younger people are making much more significant decisions than was the case when I worked in the Reagan White House. In my late 20s, I was to be seen and not heard. Fred Fielding was my boss, and I my opinions were not wanted. My research memos were wanted. Nowadays, we have 20-somethings and young 30-somethings making strategic decisions. What do you make of that change, and what does it augur for the future?
I remember during the Clinton administration, somebody joking that it used to be that a job in the White House was the culmination of a career, not a first job. And that's kind of been true ever since. One of the regrets that I had when I stepped down, when I retired as Secretary of Defense, and I made a couple of comments about it, was that I was the last senior national security advisor, a national security figure, to have worked for presidents of both parties. And sort of a personalization of the bipartisan approach to national security policy. And now these younger people who are coming into these more senior jobs have only worked in the in the Republican channel or in the Democratic channel. They serve in government when there's a Democratic president, and then they go to a think tank or some such when there's a Republican president, and vice versa on the Republican side. So they actually don't get much experience working with people across the aisle. I mean, when I became Secretary of Defense, I'd had experience working with both Republicans in Congress probably for 30 years. And so part of the problem that we have in trying to foster bipartisan policies is that the people doing the staffing and creating the options and so on have grown up in their party cylinder silo and have not had a lot of experience in the real world. Now, maybe in the think tank world, but in the real world, reaching across the aisle and figuring out how do you get support, the support of the other side for a particular policy. And, you know, there's that. And then, as you suggested at the outset, there's the lack of experience in many cases.
Well, what I was doing so many years ago, and what I expect this book, Exercise of Power, to be under the arm of President Trump and Vice President Biden if they are campaigning strategically. When President Nixon wrote The Real War, that's the book that I worked with him on, Ronald Reagan carried it with him everywhere to send a message that he was aware of the great power competition that was underway and that he wasn't going to be fooled by anybody. I don't know that great power competition is understood very much outside of our professional military caste. Do you, Mr. Secretary? I don't even know if it's taught at the PhD level like you acquired before going into the CIA. It may be a dead letter box when it comes to what people study these days.
I think it's pretty rare to find those kinds of strategic programs in universities. Some have it. My alma mater, William & Mary, does some things along that way. But I think that the real gap, frankly, is in the lack of understanding that this competition with China, and that's really where the book kind of comes together in the, yes, at the end.
Yeah,
the competition with China will be like the Cold War with the Soviets in the respect that it will take place, if we're lucky, against the backdrop of huge arms buildups, but not a direct military confrontation. And therefore, the competition will actually be played out in non-military arenas. And it's those arenas where we have so weakened ourselves and where the Chinese have invested dramatically. And that's why I think that taking actions such as walking out of the World Health Organization is such a mistake, no matter what its faults. When you leave these organizations, the Chinese move right in behind you and take all those positions that you once occupied. So if the world is about how do you shape the international environment to suit your national interests, then those institutions are one of the mechanisms you use to do that. And so and you add that to strategic communications. And I make the point in the book, I mean, why have we not been able to penetrate behind the firewalls in China to talk about the corruption of their leaders, or in Russia, or in Iran? Why have we not been able to use the much more sophisticated technological tools to get behind the iron curtains, if you will, in Russia and China and these other countries? not to try and foment revolution, but to provide the information to the people, the specifics, about how their leaders are screwing them.
How their leaders are screwing them, indeed. I'll be right back with Secretary Gates. His new book, The Exercise of Power, must reading. We talk Trump. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. President Trump tweeting that he's authorized the federal government to arrest anyone who vandalizes or destroys any monument. More on that. But first, back to my conversation with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. I had Secretary Briad on yesterday, Mr. Secretary, talking about the fact that the Chinese are exporting microreactors, nuclear reactors, all over the third world, and we're not in that game. We invented the technology. We developed the technology. We used to have a monopoly on the technology. Now we're out of the game. That's soft power. It's not DOD power, but we're out of that game. How do you re-engage a country's interest in something like that when the narrative is that it's dangerous and, you know, Three Mile Island, we're going to burn a hole to the center of the earth sort of stuff? How do you defeat 40 years of popular culture?
Well, I think it sort of goes without saying, it requires leadership. It requires, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt said that the primary responsibility of a president is to educate. And I think it takes a president, but it also takes congressional leaders saying that we need these capabilities if we're going to keep the competition with China peaceful, and we're going to need to rebuild capabilities that were dismantled during the Clinton administration. USIA was dismantled in 1998. USAID was tucked under the State Department a year later. None of these organizations have received adequate funding and so on. And so it's going to take members of Congress and the president working together to educate the American people that this is really a pretty low-cost way to carry on what is, in fact, a global competition that I think this is all of the battle between capitalism and communism, or between democracy and communism, I think is over. Communism is dead as a doornail. But authoritarianism has very, very deep roots in human history. And what we're seeing now is a reassertion of authoritarianism 30 years after the fall of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so this battle is about democracy and human rights and political rights versus authoritarians, and they are exemplified by President Xi, to a lesser extent Putin. What makes China dangerous in the non-military arena is that they're smarter and they're a lot richer than the Russians, and they have created these non-military capabilities. Belt and Road is one example. I got it. There's a lot of problems with it and so on, but it's still a $1 trillion commitment, and we have nothing comparable to it. The way they have created.
One of the themes in Exercise of Power, and I began to try and run through my memory, has anyone ever served as head of the CIA, National Security Advisor, and Secretary of Defense? And the answer is no. I think the answer is no. And that means you were uniquely understanding in the breadth and depth of espionage directed at the United States. Attorney General Barr, and by the way, did you work with Attorney General Barr closely under HW?
We overlapped for about a year, yeah.
What's your estimate of the man? Because I admire him. I esteem him quite a lot.
Well, I haven't. The only time I've seen Bill since the end of the first Bush administration was at Bush 41's funeral. And I worked with him when I was director of Central Intelligence under Bush 41. And we had a very strong relationship. And
he said an extraordinary thing on the Sunday show. I want to play for you cut number 6. He had been talking about Huawei being a backdoor into our communication system. But then he issued this sort of blanket warning about CCP espionage that I'd like the audience to hear. Cut number 6, friends.
Well, you know what? We're not speaking German today because the American business in the past didn't think that way. They stood with the United States. and all the privileges and the benefits and the stability and the rule of law and the ability to profit as they do, both as companies and individuals, comes from the strength of this country.
So should it be a law that if you are working under a grant, a United States grant at a university, you're not allowed to take money from the Chinese Communist Party?
We are clearly cracking down on researchers and others that are sent over here to get involved in our key technological programs. And by the way, this is not just weapon systems. This is agriculture. This is medicine. This is robotics. This is artificial intelligence and so forth. It's the whole gamut of important technologies going forward.
So are they seeking out people like the chairman of the, you know, chemistry department at Harvard to try to get those people to work with them? Are they seeking people out?
The Chinese efforts run the gamut from more traditional espionage of recruiting people to work for them explicitly to cultivating relationships that they're then able to use. And the people frequently are not completely attuned to the fact that they are being used as essentially stooges for the Chinese.
Stooges for the Chinese. I'm going to get Secretary Gates's response to Attorney General Barr's sweeping condemnation of people who are complicit as stooges for the Chinese Communist Party after the break. Don't go anywhere, America. We have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo coming up next hour. Senator Tom Cotton. The Heritage Hour is today. HughForHeritage.com is coming up as well. If you want to get a head start on that, head over to HughForHeritage.com and come right back for hour two of this Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.